Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
HQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Oh my, I just love my doorman. Good evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon, the place that author Robert Leland Taylor says looks like the inside of Jeannie's bottle, which is why it's so comfortable, I hope, for my guests. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, and I'm thrilled to be here again. And my guest is not here yet. Maybe I didn't give her good enough directions to the Jeannie bottle, but while I'm waiting for her, let me tell you what I've got coming up for you. Oh, well, first of all, let me tell you what's been happening. If you've missed any of these shows, you know they're always available for free download afterwards here on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes or on Stitcher. And if you're listening on Blog Talk Radio, if you would, you see that little follow button. It's kind of a rectangle. Please click follow and follow me. I certainly would appreciate it. And it helps me. Or if you subscribe on Blog Talk Radio or if you subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, it helps me to get sponsors and it helps me to get guests. More cool guests like the kinds I've been having this year and last year, too, that have been so much fun. Who am I talking about? Well, let's see. We had Holly Overton. She's a writer for the TV show Shadow Hunters, which is on Freeform, and she has a book, Baby Doll, fantastic suspense thriller, Holly Overton. Jennifer Irwin, who came on to talk about her book, Address the Color of the Sky, which is being made into a movie before it's published, but now she's working out the contract on the publishing deal, and I'm so happy for Jennifer Irwin. Also, we've had, of course, our dear friend, Reno Soriano, and, you know, he's been here three times. Reno is our holistic health coach, and every time he comes, he wants to raise us up a bit, and his books, he's got so many great books, Sensational Slimming Secrets, The Illumination Codes, and he's been teaching us how to detox our life story. And I've been taking away, if you listen to the last time he was on a couple of weeks ago, I've taken a couple of his, three specifically, three suggestions he gave me. And anyone who knows me has heard me moan for years about insomnia. Not in the since I've been doing this. Now, it's been 2 weeks that I've been following this from him. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because I want you to listen because what you may take away or what you may need could be very different from what I need. But so that's why I'm not going to tell you what it is. But these tips from Reno Soriano have helped me a lot. Last night we had Mae McCarthy on. And Mae is an angel investor, speaker, trainer, entrepreneur, businesswoman. She teaches you how to, the path to wealth and abundance through following your intuition. And she also said last night that anyone who listens to the show, to Madame Perry Salon, if you go to her website, maymccarthy.com, you can download the first three chapters of her book for free. Just go to her store section and follow that. Also, you know, we had Chasm Sultan from Joan Jett, Todd Rundgren, Utopia, Celine Dion, Meatloaf, he was on. He's got a CD out called Bootleg. This is that is his. Chasm Sultan. I think it's his third CD of just his music out. Get that. He's fantastic. If you love him with all those people, you'll love him all by himself. And I've got some great shows coming up soon. We're going to be having Alison Arngrim, who was her book is called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. Prairie Bitch, yes. She was little Nellie Olson, the little bad girl on Full House on the Prairie. And next Wednesday, the 15th, I've got filmmaker and musician.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to hear from you. Just talking about you.
Oh, awesome. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted. So you're going to be here next Wednesday. The show is dedicated to you and the film project you've got coming up.
Wow. I'm excited. And I'm looking forward to sharing my project. I really am.
I am too, because the more I get to know about you, you know, you're one of these people that don't go around bragging about yourself, and then once we learn more about you, we think, dang, if I had done even half of that, I'd be talking about it all the time. But you don't. You just get in there, you're in the studio, you're doing the work. Every time I talk to you, you go, I'm in the studio right now, what's up? You know, what do you need? And which is more than I deserve from you. But you're always, yeah, let me get back in the studio, what you need? You're making it happen. I mean, you know, I've heard, inspiration finds you when you're working, is what I've heard. I think
that's right.
That from Johnny Marr, and I don't know who else said it. But that's how you live.
That is how I live. I mean, creativity is something that comes to you when it wants. I mean, you have to have yourself open to it, to attract it, you have to have the desire to want to create. And if you're an artist, I mean, creating is something that is nonstop. I mean, even when my hands aren't playing the piano or my mind is doing music or I'm still thinking in terms of my art. So it's a never-ending process. And now that I'm a filmmaker, and when I say filmmaker, I mean as a film producer. I'm not aspiring to be a director. I think I'm a decent writer and I'm a great idea man. But sound and music and recording is my forte. So it's where I stick, it's where I stay, it's my lane. But I have a great association with some of the most talented people that can grab a camera and edit, and they know what to do with lighting, they know what to do with makeup and hair, they know what to do with art and colors. And these are things that are on the image side, and we make a great partnership. So, you know, that's my success story for me.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, as I said, and I've got to say this, I've got to back myself up on this one. It's always the people, you know, that don't go around bragging about themselves, that really have the legit stuff going on, and you do. And the more I've learned about you, especially your days in New York working with A&R Records, well, you called in when I had Glenn Berger on, and Glenn had a book called Never Say No to a Rock Star, about his early days in the 70s working with Phil Ramone and A&R Records. And so when you were on when you guys had all these stories that sort of intertwined with each other. That was so exciting.
We have people in common. It's a small world. It's less than 6 degrees, less than 4 degrees, less than 3 degrees. With me and Glenn, it's 2 degrees separation. We got all these people in common. And I find that with a lot of people in the industry I know, and people that aren't in the industry that may know someone in the industry. I mean, you know, I've been doing this all my life. It's been a lifelong, it's the career that I chose, you know, hell or high water. You know, I stayed with it, you know, and it stayed with me. It's in me, so, you know. So, yeah, Glenn and I have a lot of people in common. A lot of my best experiences come out of those days, 1981, 1982, and 83, New York City. 79 to 80 was okay, but I was still in college, so I had to come back to college, you know.
Yeah, I think I remember some story about being woke up at 3 or 4 a.m. to go down to the studio for Mick Jagger or something you did like that.
That was midnight. it was midnight. I wasn't supposed to work that rehearsal session. It was a rehearsal session for Saturday Night Live, and I worked for Bill Sonnenberg, and my Uncle Hal, I was staying with my Uncle Hal, my Aunt Gail, and I came home and went to sleep at, you know, 10:30 or quarter to 11 or whatever, and I got woke up at midnight. Yo, your boss sent a car, the Rolling Stones are waiting on you. And I was like, Pat was supposed to work that session. Well, I ended up going down and working the rehearsal session. I got there and they were 15 SVT bass amps up and PA and keyboards and everything, you know, blah blah, you heard it.
Yeah, I heard it, but some of the people listening right now haven't heard it, so that's why I'm glad you're here to share. I mean, what a story.
Yeah, we were at Bill Studios was across from SIR, Studio Instrument Rentals, on 52nd Street in New York City, back in the early 80s. And we did all the quintessential rehearsals that were not going to use SIR. SIR was the large commercial rehearsal operation, you know. And we have a place in Atlanta called Crossover Sound that's a lot like SIR was. Bill's didn't have the big mirrored walls and the balance beam going across and whatnot. These were just raw rehearsal rooms with stages and lights and sound and that whole nine yards, you know. And the Rolling Stones opted to rehearse with us because we had an independent contract with NBC, with Saturday Night Live and some of the talk shows. And anybody that did those shows ended up rehearsing with us instead of, you know, like a big tour rehearsal facility like SIR. So we had some premium acts work with us. It wasn't just the Stones. It was Stevie Wonder, Lonnie Liston Smith, Ramsey Lewis, Chic, Duran Duran, Power Station. There was a few more people. Count Basie. I met Count Basie at Bill's. Yeah. So anyway, I didn't want to make this all about me, but you know, that all led to where I'm at now. I mean, my dad, you know, put the piano in my hands like he had, and he put a camera in my hands, you know, a Bell and Howell silent film camera. And I mean, I'm 11 years old, and you know, that's 47 years.
Whoa, baby. Well,
yeah,
as we say in the South, you was raised right.
I was raised right. I certainly was. Mom and Pop, they did it.
I don't know if you met Frank DeVille Greenfield on the show. He's a guitar player. He's on tour with the Gap Band now. You didn't call in that night, did you?
No, yeah. I didn't. But I did a show. I was the front of house mix for a band called The Strikers. They had a hit out in the early 80s called Body Music. And we opened up for the Gap Band in Union City, Virginia, I think it was. Union City, Virginia, and then we did a show in Raleigh, North Carolina. Those are my two Gap Band times, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. Of course, because I think this is Ron Wilson. This is not Charlie, because Charlie was in Atlanta last weekend. One day I'll have
Uncle Charlie.
To go see Charlie.
Uncle Charlie. I can't wait to catch up with him. I can't wait to see. I haven't seen anybody in so long. It's been, you know, that long.
I know the feeling. Well, you know, because there's a Ron White Gap Band, and then there's, of course, you know, Charlie. I thought, is this going to be like, and then, of course, you know, with Funkadelic, it became Original P and P-Funk All-Stars. And I thought, so is Gap Band going to end up being like the Temptations, where there's several different versions out on the road, like a Broadway musical, different companies out on the road? Each one has one original Temptation. Are you still with me?
I'm here. Is that directed at me?
I'll just ask him. It's making a conversation about it. You know, do you think they'll...
Oh, no. I don't know. It seems like there are going to be several incarnations of the Gap Band because of the people and the rights. You know, there were three Temptations, and now there's only one Temptations. But I know what that's like. I don't know. I hope not. I mean, to me, the Gap Band is the original three brothers from the Gap Band. And without Charlie Wilson, it's not the Gap Band at all to me. You know, Charlie Wilson is the Gap Band, you know, to me.
It's
like picking up the OJs. That's not going to work, you know. I just can't see.
Well, that's true. Yep. Well, I can tell you're in your car. Where are you headed to now?
I am headed to a studio.
Okay.
I'm headed to work with Flip Gucci. We have a commercial we have to turn in so we can get the next commercial tomorrow. Dacia Sledge, who's front of house for Alicia Keys and for, who else did she do? Young M.A., Alicia Keys, and somebody else she's on the road with. But anyway, she's a front of house mixer. You know, we all kind of stick together and give each other gigs when we know we need work. And I do voiceovers, so I'm doing some voiceover commercials for her. And I'm going to work with Flip. Flip is a filmmaker, and he's also an awesome recording engineer and producer, and he has a great studio. So between Chambly and the South End and the West End and the East End, I'm in five studios right now. right now this minute, I'm in a car, but like 5 studios in the past month working on, I'm trading out, I'm working, getting paid, but I'm trading out the time so I can get time to work on what I'm doing for this film.
Well, I am so proud of you, and I can't wait until next Wednesday when you are my guest right here. I've got you all to myself here, Madame Perry Salon, and anybody that wants to call you, of course.
Thank you. That's why I'm trying to keep my mouth shut all up for next week.
Yeah, just give them a little tease. Give them a little tease. That's all I'm saying.
That's right. There you go.
Thank
you
again
so much.
Thank
you. All right. Have a great evening, everyone.
All right. Good night.
Look forward to next week. Thank you, Jennifer.
All right. Be here. Okay. And that, of course, my fabulous friend, Vincent Levy Bryant, musician, filmmaker, scriptwriter, fantastic guy. Now, Diane Dimon, my guest for tonight, she's an American TV journalist, reporter, host, investigative reporter, or investigative journalist, some people could say. She's best known for her coverage of Michael Jackson. She's author of the book Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. She also wrote Cirque du Soleil, Be Careful Who You Trust. And that was about the Salahi. Remember the couple that crashed one of the White House events some years back? And she also has a book called Thinking Outside the Crime and Justice Box. She's worked as a correspondent for Hard Copy, Extra, Entertainment Tonight, and Court TV, as well as she's been on CNN, HLN. I believe she subbed for Nancy Grace before when she was out. So I'm very excited. Very excited to have Diane Dimon on, but she's not here yet. So I'm going to play a song by a band called from Liverpool, England. And these guys are, they're busy. They're going places. You're going to be seeing them over in the U.S., I think, later on this year. But they've been taken under the wing of Noel Gallagher, you know, from Oasis. And he's had them play a lot of events that his High Flying Birds are playing at. They're also all over the BBC. Doing live shows there. And the name is Joe Symes and the Loving Kind. So right now, while I'm waiting for Diane Dimon to come here to the Genie's Bottle, I'm going to play Joe Symes and the Loving Kind. This is their song, Things Get Better.
See the
that was a song, Things Get Better by Joe Symes and the Loving Kind. That's a rockin' band out of Liverpool, England, and I am so excited to have them on Madame Perry Salon. They'll be here on Tuesday, April 4th. And in fact, what I'm going to do while I'm waiting for Diane Diamond, I'm going to, let's see, tell you who all's coming up. Okay. Vincent Levy Bryant, who we spoke to earlier, filmmaker, screenwriter, and musician. He'll be here on the 15th of March. On the 21st, Kat O'Keefe Canavas. Now, she is a dream therapist, and I met her a few years ago in New York at Book Expo with her book Surviving Cancerland. And she talks about how she was able to learn about and diagnose her own cancer and where it was and tell her doctor just from her dreams. And she's also going to be analyzing our dreams, your dreams, if you call in that night. That'll be the 21st. Also coming soon, Kenneth W. Kane. He's a horror writer. He is with our friends Crystal Lake Publishing, run by Joe Meinhardt. And we love Crystal Lake Publishing. They have great authors, and I'm sure Kenneth is going to be fun to talk with. Sometime soon, we're going to have a lady named Kate Moore. She wrote a book called The Radium Girls. It's about women in America back in, I think, around the 30s, 40s, who were working at a factory painting little radium, bits of radium onto the dials or the hands of clocks or watches. And they were told to dip their little paintbrush in the substance and then use their lips to make it into a fine point before they painted. And they began having a lot of trouble. Their bones were cracking and disintegrating, and they were getting crippled. These were very young women because of the radium, but they were railroaded and backstabbed and just shafted every way possible by the owners of the company, the doctors they hired, the politicians that were in their pockets. It took a long time for these ladies to get any kind of justice. Also, we're going to be having Alison Arngrim, a fantastic actress and author. Right this month, she's doing a play, the Agatha Christie play, And Then There Were None, at the Judson Theater. And you may know her. Her book is called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. She also does stand-up. She has a great one-woman show. She was Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie, and she has quite a remarkable story. I have a lot of respect for that lady. And again, this is April 4th, Joe Symes from The Loving Kind. And sometime after that will be the Twang Bar King, Adrian Belew, just having the coolest guest. Like I said, my friend Janet Goodman, who's a musician herself, said, "You have the coolest guest." Well, yeah, because I've got the coolest listener, so I've got to keep the game up for you guys. Now, don't have Diane Diamond here yet. I hope no one is holding me. Oh, let's see. Hope no one's holding her hostage. Okay. All right. Well, I'll go ahead, and I've got a message. Diane Diamond needs help getting in the genie's bottle. So I'm going to call her right now. Yeah, so I'm going to get her in here, and let's see. Get her right here. And don't forget, you can call in here. The number is 646-716-9922. Now, let's get Diane Diamond in here. And I've been reading her book, Be Careful Who You Love. Kind of takes me back like a little snapshot in time, actually, to the days. I remember the news breaking and the story.
Hello?
Diane!
Yes?
Welcome to the Genie's Bottle of this Madame Perry Salon.
Thank you so much. Thank you for calling.
This is the lied. I'm so sorry. I thought I had given you the number here in the email. I'm so sorry.
You know, you may have, and I have to be honest with you. I have a clock in my office that stopped, and I did not realize it had stopped. I'm so sorry.
Listen, that's happened to me. So I can identify with that completely. Listen,
I got to get my husband to get me a new battery here.
I understand. Well, you know, I'm glad to have you here, and we're so excited about this. I was just telling everybody about the things you've done and about how reading Be Careful Who You Love inside the Michael Jackson case is like a snapshot in time. It takes me back. You know, I don't know if you know Rudy Sarzo. He was the bass player for Quiet Riot and Ozzy, and he wrote a book called Off the Rails about his tour with Ozzy when his good friend Randy Rhoads died in an airplane crash. And he said, I wanted the book to be like a little snapshot in time of those days, that era. You know, and I said, yeah. And I feel that same way when I'm reading your books. Like, you take us back to the time. Because I can remember that, the things that you read.
That's so nice you say that, because I remember having a discussion with my publisher about, you know, how are you going to write this Michael Jackson book? And I said, you know, I want to take the reader inside the newsroom. When I first got the assignment that there were police at the door of his ranch and his condo in Los Angeles, and it was my assignment to find out why. And I'd never covered a celebrity story before. I'm a crime reporter, you know. So that's the way in which I wrote the book, just sort of chronologically taking you along the ride that I took.
And yes, that's the thing. I mean, you're a drunk, but you've covered crime, but not celebrity crime.
That's right. That's right. And before I really got into the crime and justice genre, I covered politics on Capitol Hill. And some people have asked me, what's the difference? And I say, well, you know, sometimes there's not much difference between crime and justice and politics. But that was long ago.
Yeah, well, I know from, I was married to a homicide detective.
Oh, my.
For 7 years. So yeah, I know that's a big difference when he's working that kind of case, and then when it's somebody who's a politician or a celebrity or whatever, everything takes on a whole different circus almost. You know, everybody.
Yeah. It sure does. And then, you know, I have to be honest, I got sort of pulled into being in a position when I wrote the Michael Jackson book that I wasn't used to being. You know, I'm a who, what, why, where, when kind of gal, and I just gather facts and tell stories, and then all of a sudden, I became the story. And it was really strange. It was, you know, at first you kind of laugh about it, and then it gets really serious. There were crazy fans saying that I was having an affair with the district attorney, and that's where I was getting all my information. And I'm thinking, really? That guy? I mean, he's a good Catholic married with 10 kids, and I'm happily married. We live hundreds of miles apart. I couldn't wrap my head around it, you know. But you just sort of persevere. I remember coming out of the office at Hard Copy. I was working at Hard Copy when I broke all the Michael Jackson stories. And one day there was a gaggle of young people outside the gate. I had to go outside the gates of Paramount Pictures studio lot, that's where the office was, and cross the street into a parking structure to get to my car. And there was this group of kids there, kind of near the Arsenio Hall studio, and I didn't think anything of it until I heard one of them say, "There she is!" And then I realized it was a group of Michael Jackson fans that were not at all happy with what I was reporting. I got in my car, got away. The next day, there were about four times as many kids standing and waiting, fans, Michael Jackson fans. So the boss got me a different parking space in a different part of the lot and gave me a security guard to take me to and from home. And it got really hairy at some points. You know, if you were married to a detective, you know, it's kind of weird sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It definitely does. And, you know, you can read about it. You can think, you can imagine what it's like. But something, you know, like your situation, you even had a secure, before you got a special place, you were in a secured parking lot, you thought, and your car was broken into, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. After that, they put me into the big lot inside the studio gates, you know, those big Paramount gates, and it was right outside the legal department, and that's where you're going to park. I said, oh, okay, that's great. But it still didn't deter people who wanted to get to me. They broke into my car and stole a bunch of documents that were pretty sensitive. And anyway, yeah, I could tell you stories about covering that story because I just covered it for so many years. Yeah, we first broke the story in 1993, and then there was a lull, and in 2003, I was living back in New York, and I got a call from a source who said, there's another kid, and this time this family is going to take it to court. And I said, wow, what's going to happen? Well, going to be a big search at Neverland. I said, when? And it happened to fall right around my birthday. So I got on a plane and took a couple camera crews, and we were the only ones standing outside Neverland when they raided it in 2003, November 2003. So
now, November 2003, when they raided it, now that wasn't that before they went to take the photographs?
Well, no, that's when they took the photographs. They came in. If you can imagine this, Madame, 70. Vehicles coming in, 70 cop cars, 70 big forensic vans. There were police on, like, scooters, because they had one day. It was early in the morning, 8 o'clock, and they had one day. That's all the warrants said, one day to search this huge ranch with all of these outbuildings and all of these guest quarters. And so they just came in with 70 different vehicles. And that's when they took lots and lots of pictures of everything. But are you talking about the body pictures?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a different day. That was a different day. I wasn't there for that. That was the district attorney's office telling Michael Jackson he had to drop trow so they could take pictures of his private parts and see if it matched the description that the young boy had given of certain markings on his private parts.
But
I'm trying to keep this clean.
There, I got you. Yeah, you know what you're doing. When you were there, you said 70?
Yeah, 70 vehicles came in down this long, dusty road. Yeah. 8 o'clock in the morning. It was like I was in a movie. You know, it was like I was watching some Invasion of Normandy film or something. I couldn't believe. I knew there was going to be a raid, but I had no idea how many police vehicles and how many officers were going to be involved. And they stayed till about 11 o'clock at night.
So they only had the one day, and they just had to bring in everyone that could tow, carry, and drive something off, I guess.
They had to blanket photograph the whole place. I can't remember now how big Neverland was. It was like 29 acres or something, and there were buildings all over it, you know. But, you know, people remember me, I think, for the Michael Jackson case, but I have this whole other body of work, lots of other stories I've covered. I write a syndicated column once a week on crime, and I'm working on my fourth book, and I have done other things other than just Michael Jackson.
Yes, I'm not going to act like this. I've been telling everybody the other books you've written and what you've done. I know you've filled in with Nancy Grace, and you've also done Ben Cortese. You've got a whole lot of stuff going on. And I also want to say, what about this then? Here's a case that's not as sensational as the Michael Jackson, remember, but Cirque du Soleil. Be careful who you trust.
Oh, yes.
That was about the wild couple that crashed White House event. Tell us about that.
Yeah, who doesn't remember that case? It was the crazy White House gate crashers, and you know, with the crazy name, were they Palestinian? The Salahis? Where did they come from? How did they get in the White House? It was such a scandal. I remember it happened right around Thanksgiving, and you know, and Thanksgiving newsrooms don't have a lot of people in them because everybody's on vacation, and here comes this flash from the Washington Post gate crashers, and they, oh my gosh, and they got so close to the president, and oh, golly, golly, hand-wringing. And it just took off. This story went worldwide, and I wanted to know why. What do you mean somebody snuck into the White House? I covered the White House. I'll tell you, you just don't just sneak in. You just don't. Your name has to be on a list, and the Secret Service checks you out. And when they started, I can't remember exactly when, but there were congressional hearings where they called this couple, Mikhail and Tark Salahi, they called them up to the Hill to testify about how they'd gotten in. She was very glamorous with her long blonde hair, and he very stoic, and they took the Fifth. You know, it was like, oh. I'm sorry, I can't answer any questions. It became so dramatic. So I had a source, a literary source, who said to me, they want to tell their story. They want to tell their real story. Do you want to write this book? And I said, no, I don't really think so. He said, no, you have to come and meet them. So I went to Virginia, and I stayed there for quite a while getting to know this couple, and I realized they were like the least threatening people I'd ever met. They were kind of party-goers and dilettantes, and his parents owned a vineyard, and, you know, they had just gotten themselves on a secondary list to get into the White House for the state dinner. The state dinner, apparently, the invites go out months ahead of time, and there had been some cancellations. Well, this was the first state dinner for Obama. He didn't want to have empty tables. So they went to the secondary list and started calling people, you know, late, hey, do you want to come to the state dinner? And they jumped at it. And their names were on the secondary list. And because this has got so many layers to it, she was one of the Real Housewives of D.C., so there was a camera crew that had followed her to the White House. They had captured the check-in. They had on camera a Secret Service person saying, oh, yeah, okay, go, come on in and go on down to that next checkpoint. And you see them walk in, tra-la-la, they're gone to the party. But NBC, Bravo, is the one that does that television show. They sat on that footage for the longest time. They knew that they'd gotten in the White House perfectly fine, perfectly above board, but they never told anybody. They let the controversy just simmer and fester and, you know, congressional hearings and all of this. So when I discovered all of that, I said, you know what? This is ridiculous. Yes, let's write a book and tell the real story about this. And so I did. And that's Cirque du Salahi is the name of that book. That's kind of a long story, wasn't it?
But this information is legit. And by the way, Diane, I know I'm going to be gushed. I'm such a fan of yours, so I don't want to go fangirl question, but I'm just so excited. You can tell the long story. I'm ready for it. But you said they had the truth. They had the real story, but it was sat on. Because I guess it wasn't as salacious as, oh, how did they get in? How did they break in?
Because I think they wanted to build the suspense. And they wanted to have people go, wow, well, you know, Bravo's going to show the day that they went to the White House in a month, so I'll have to keep watching to see what really happens. And it built up their audience by keeping it secret.
Oh, okay. Yes, of course. I should figure that. When I took entertainment or film unit publicity at UCLA under Henri Bollinger, that's one of the things this was some years back. I was surprised, but I shouldn't have been surprised to learn, was that for film unit publicity, we were taught how to plan. I know that you know about this, but how to plan what you would leak and when. You know, it got leaked. You know, you got to plan these things. Okay, on this day, we're going to wink, leak this. You know?
Yeah, wink, wink. Well, that's what good publicists do, you know, and especially in Hollywood, I'll tell you, and especially in Washington, D.C., and in New York, you know, the brains behind the Real Housewives, that series is here in New York. And they knew what they were doing. They just held on to it, and they just kept letting the furor rise and grow and become fever pitch, and then boom, they had the night where they actually showed the video, and it was like, oh my God, look, they didn't crash. They walked right in with the Secret Service invitation. So I really wrote that book because I wanted to show how manufactured some stories are that the public gets. You know, this all started with two gossip columnists at the Washington Post who were standing vigil the night of the very first State of the Union, taking notes and, you know, who's arriving and what are they wearing and oh, tra-la-la, and here come the Salahis. Well, the reporter who was at the White House had a long simmering feud with the Salahis. That's another whole story I won't bore you with. And when she saw them walk in, she quickly looked at the official first draft of the guest list, and she didn't see their name. So they must be crashing. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. It was as easy as that.
Oh, well, but when you met them though, were they? Because I've seen pictures of you with them, you know,
yes,
photos, and they just you said very unassuming, just nice folks.
Well, no, they're kind of, not unassuming, but kind of larger than life. You know, she has this long, tall, thin blonde with long blonde hair, and she, you know, she looks kind of ditzy, and then she starts talking to you, and she has this voice that sounds like, you know, Greta Garbo or something. She's very arresting to talk to. Tarek Salahi, her husband, they're now divorced, not a surprise to me, was very controlling. He was very savvy about what you're talking about, PR. He always wanted to spin something like, here's our vineyard, and we have championship wines. Well, come to find out they never really won anything for their wines. I tried their wines. I like wine. I didn't like their wine. You know what I mean? So he was a real salesman, and I watched because I stayed with them. I mean, I was in a hotel, but I spent the days and nights with them watching them in interaction, and he was a real pusher. He was a real, hey, you know, I got my wife on TV, and now I'm going to be on TV too. Wow, and I'm going to get a show, and I'm going to do this. And he was a real P.T. Barnum type, frankly. And
right.
I always stayed in touch with Mikkel and wrote in the book about the two men that she had ever loved in her life, the other one being Neil Schon, the lead guitarist of Journey. And, yeah, well, she called me one day and she said, I'm finally leaving this guy. I said, really? She said, as a matter of fact, I've already left him. I said, Mikkel, where are you? She said, I'm with Neil. So they got married, and my husband and I were invited to the wedding in San Francisco. It was a grand affair at the Art Plaza there. It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Oh,
so they're together, very, very happy, very loving.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember the Neil Schon part of it now. So all these things start coming back to me. So fantastic. So do you still keep in touch? Or I can't imagine.
We do. Well, I'm so busy, and they're so busy. Neil is still touring all over the world. I think last I heard they were going to go to Japan and whatnot. So we don't see each other much. Whenever they're in town, I live in New York, they leave tickets for us to go see them. We saw them at thank you. My husband's reminding me, Madison Square Garden with Santana. Oh, that was that was a great night. So
that sounds like a great night. And let's see, now you have another book, Thinking Outside the Crime and Justice Box.
Right.
Now that's not a tutorial, is it?
Well, no, I'll tell you what it is. It is I've been writing a syndicated column since, oh gosh, about 2008. And my syndicator, Creators Syndicate, said to me, let's get together a compilation of your best columns, your favorite columns. Let's update them. Let's write some new text. Let's put them in chapters and context and put it out as a book. I said, okay. So that's what that is. That's sort of the cream of the crop of my past columns on everything having to do with crime and justice, but from the human point of view, you know, what happens to kids when both their parents are in prison? Why are our prisons so full? You know, do police use the proper techniques to interrogate people when they bring them in to interrogate them? Is there a better way to do it? So it's all sorts of umbrella issues surrounding the crime and justice genre, so to speak. So that's what that is.
It's not okay. I gotcha.
Yeah, no. I don't think I'd write one of those. And I'm working on another book now. It's a real problem with society, frankly, in my estimation. As America gets older, our parents are getting older. They're living longer. They're suffering from dementia. And, you know, families complain and worry and fight about what to do with mom or dad when they get old. And sometimes family members, say a brother and a sister, can't agree. And the brother gets mad and says, I'm going to court. I'm going to take this to court because I think I know best what to do with mom or dad. Well, once you take it to court, your nightmare begins, I have discovered. It's a real little known part of the justice system that when you go to court arguing over this, the judge doesn't have time to sit and listen to your family dynamic and your family battle. So here's what they do. They declare your parent incapacitated. And if you guys are really fighting and nobody gets along, they appoint a guardian. And that person has total control over your parent's life. You have no more say. This guardian, because your parent has been declared incapacitated, they lose all their civil rights. They can't hire a lawyer. They can't vote. They can't travel. They can't spend their money. They can't do anything. It's all up to this guardian. And there are some wonderful, fabulously dedicated guardians out there across the country. But there are also some real crooks, some real unscrupulous types. And they will just spend all of your parents' money. And you can only stand by and watch as your inheritance goes down the drain, as they ignore your parents' last will and testament and power of attorney. They just ignore all that, and the court lets them do it. So that's what my next book is about. And that is kind of a tutorial, kind of a self-help. What do you do if you find yourself in this position? You know, my first piece of advice is never go to court. Go to mediation or do anything, but don't take it to court, for God's sake. Probate court will eat you up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. I want to welcome into, we have a caller in here. Welcome into Madam Perry's Salon. Kenya Colbert, my BFF. Kenya, come on in and meet Diane Diamond.
Hello.
Hello, Miss Diane. How are you today?
I'm very good. I was a little tardy calling in, and I really apologize for that. I blame it on a bad clock.
There you go. I don't mind at all.
I'm not as mean as I look. It's okay.
Well, I am enjoying you right now in your next book. Oh, my gosh, Diane. I don't know why this has not been written yet, but thank you for writing this. You do see that a lot, the parents, you know, the children squabbling, but I didn't know that part about when it goes to court, what happens. I mean, I see it in famous families, but had no idea it happened in everyday life as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, it usually happens, I'll be honest with you, with people who have a little bit of money. Because they're not helping themselves to somebody who's on Social Security. They're helping themselves to somebody who's got, 800 grand that their husband left them, or $1 million or something like that. But yeah, it's amazing. Nobody really knows about this system. I'm glad you're interested.
Yeah, it's so sad. But it's crazy that they are allowed to get away with it to me. Sometimes those people who are watching, that's where that saying comes from, that watches or needs to be watched as well.
Right.
Because someone needs to be watching that. But you don't know until you know.
It's up to the judge. The judge is the, you know, absolute arbiter. They're supposed to be watching how these people spend the elder person's money and, you know, if they're getting the right doctors, getting to the right medical professionals and all that, but the, frankly, court systems nationwide, they don't have enough money for that. They don't have people who can sit down and audit these statements that the guardians put in. And by the way, they only have to put them in once a year. And I've looked at some of these statements. They look like a check register. They, you know, I spent $4,000 with this company. Well, what'd you buy? Oh, I don't. I spent it. Nobody makes them justify anything. It's just crazy. It's crazy.
But when you describe the situation that starts it, it makes such perfect sense. Like you said, with the people go, if the family members start to squabble and they go in front of a judge, nobody wants to hear, especially grown-up kids, squabble.
Exactly.
And it can get so petty. And so they don't, okay, fine, forget it, I'll appoint someone. You know, that makes, I can see that now.
You know, and it's ironic in that I don't want to taint, I don't want to label people, but it's kind of like the bad seed in the family that nobody's listening to. They're the ones that run to the courthouse first. And they get a lawyer who's all too willing to write a petition that says all the other siblings are neglectful and mean and abusive and not attentive. And so that one person who gets to the courthouse first files the papers, and now, boom, your parent is in the system, and there really is nothing you can do to get them out. I've been investigating this for more than a year, and I can tell you two cases, one in Nevada and one in Florida, where a child, adult child, really fought to get their parent out of guardianship, and they were successful. And the one case in Florida, break your heart, her name was Geraldine, and her two boys fought. One of them took it to court, and then they realized what they'd done.
Yes.
And they fought for 2 years, got her out of guardianship. She was so happy, and they posted pictures of happy mom every day on Facebook, and 6 weeks later, she dropped dead.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that awful?
That is
so
horrible. But see, I think that when you started that, you said, like, they're squabbling, and I think that, and I don't, I mean, I'm blessed that that's not a problem that I've had to deal with, and I don't think I would ever have to, but I don't think that people see it before it gets here. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you see those siblings that don't get along anyway, and then that might become a problem. There just seems to be something in your will, maybe, or something that you can do ahead of time to prevent that.
Well, but you can put it in a will, and they can ignore it. You know, you put in the will that I want my son Charlie to be my power of attorney. Well, your son Sammy went to court and said Charlie's a bad man. So the judge has ruled that you guys are out of the picture now, and the guardian decides. The guardian can ignore that power of attorney. They can ignore the will. I don't want to sell my house. I want you to sell these apartments of mine before you sell my house. Doesn't matter. They can do whatever they want.
I look forward to your book. I really
do. Oh, thank you. You have to have me back when I can finally tell you where to buy it and all that.
Oh, would you do that?
Yes, absolutely. I know people who come on your show just call you back and beg to get back on. I'll be one of them.
I'm not as mean as I look. It's like, oh, well, I'm scared to come. Don't be scared to come on. Like, oh, that was scary. I hope not.
That was pretty fun.
Yes, please do. Please do. Oh, actually, I don't know. You probably know, I think I mentioned Harvey J.K. I don't know if you know him. Because I remember before when I first asked him, he said, do you even know what I write about? Well, yeah, Harvey, I would check that out because I just want to know, you know. He goes, I just want to make sure you really know what you're getting into here, Charlie. I mean, Harvey, yeah, I got this, you know. And then after that, but he was such a sweetheart. It's a pleasure to have on. But, so I would love for you to come back. Because that is, and it's like Kenya said, why don't we have a book like that already? How many people are going through this, and no one knows how to get through that? And
Yeah,
and it's a frustration, a waste of money. Not and like the lady you were talking about, Geraldine, that, and what a waste of time. They only have
and money.
Time.
You know, your parents scrimp and save. This generation now that we're losing, they're the last ones to really scrimp and save, and you know, for the next generation. And I want my children to have this money, and then only to see some stranger come in spending it all, and your children are being accused of being greedy for wanting to have a say in how you're being cared for. Oh, you're just after the money. Isn't that ironic that a for-profit guardian or conservator would say that? And they're making up to $300 an hour just to take a letter that you gave them and mail it in the post office. It's maddening. If anyone is really wants to delve into this topic or they have a problem like this themselves, go to my website. It's easy, DianeDiamond.com. And on the left-hand side, there is a link to a series I just wrote. I went on a hiatus from my national research on this topic because I got so many letters from New Mexico. Families in New Mexico complaining about this, and it's especially egregious there because the whole system is kept secret. They sequester all of the cases there so nobody can talk about it. Nobody can, give out any documents, or there's no public transparency. Well, you know me. I got a whole bunch of documents, and I got a whole bunch of families that would talk to me. Took me about 10 months, but I wrote a 6-part series, and you can find it on my website. Again, just go to DianeDiamond.com and scroll down on the left. You'll see a picture of a beautiful elderly woman there who is the focus of the series and what happened to her during 5 years under guardianship. 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's an amazing story, and it's actually, I'm going back to Albuquerque for a presentation later this month, and then the next week I'm going to give the keynote address at a group of state administrators that take on securities and financial fraud against seniors. They read my series and they said, "What? We're flabbergasted. We had no idea this was happening. Come and speak to us." So I'm spreading the word and you're helping me. Thank you.
Very good. I wouldn't say where I put that. You know, I just have this little saying that sticks in my brain all the time, and sometimes it proves true, that sometimes when we know better, we do better. And sometimes it's good for somebody to put that out there, just different things that we need to know, because the people who are maybe thinking that this is just between our family and the courts are going to come in and decide – they don't know what the rest of the story is until you tell them.
Right.
So it's wonderful that you're making that known. Honestly, just if only for, even if they're just doing it for the money, you're still not going to get the money if the courts get involved. So that'll keep people from just going there for that.
Exactly. And who would think the system, your taxpayer-funded system that you turn to for help, hey, I've got a real problem in my family here, I need some help, would then turn on you and bring in complete and total strangers to handle every bit of your parents' personal and financial affairs. And see, these guardians and conservators come in, they don't do a lot of work. They hire a bunch of people. They hire a caretaker, and they hire somebody to come mow the lawn and clean the pool and walk your dog, and somebody else to come pick up the poop from the dog. And guess who pays for everything? All of that money for the guardian, the conservator, and everybody they hire comes out of the elder person's bank account.
Wow.
That's where all the money's going.
Oh.
Yeah.
I could talk for hours
downright
about this.
And that's downright criminal.
Yes.
It is.
I believe it is. I believe it is a bad solution to a problem that we all have, not all of us, but many of us have, and it's just gotten so corrupt. It was set up as a nice way to help families deal with this problem, and it's just gone kaflooey from this cottage industry of people who have glommed on to this system. I mean, I'll tell you, there are stories of, they call them trolls, hanging around emergency rooms to watch if an old person comes in an ambulance who's all by themselves. And they'll say, hey, oh, honey, you're all by yourself. Just sign this paper. I'll help you out. Or they go to senior citizens and they say, you know, senior citizen centers, and they have lectures, and they say, you know, you want your children to just be your children. So let us take care of your financial, you know, paying your bills and doing all. We'll take care of it. Just sign this paper.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, suddenly you're in guardianship. So.
Yeah, wow. Unbelievable.
Well, you know, yes, we are going to be looking for this book, and we'll be thrilled to have you come back and talk to it. And if you're listening, Diane Dimond, her website, DianeDimond.com. If you know anything of mine, any social media of mine, Madame Perry Salon or Jennifer Perry, I will have every link I can to her site. If you don't get her syndicated column in your paper or whatever you read, it is also on her website. In fact, the latest column was, the title is Time for States to Cut the Cord with Washington.
That's right.
This week, yeah. And then there's also, as she said, on the left side, there's a column, the Breaking Investigative Report, about the things she's just talking about, the how over
guardianship,
the,
yeah. Who guards the guardians is the name of it. Indeed.
Diane Dimond, for Pete's sake, I am just so thrilled to have you here. And, of course, her books, Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case, Cirque du Soleil, Be Careful Who You Trust, Thinking Outside the Crime and Justice Box. Just a fantastic lady, and I am thrilled to have you here talking with me and my best friend. And we look forward. And where can people see you? Do you have your... On your, because this is your nice new website. You have all your events. Oh, public speaking, people can hire you.
Yes, I do give a lot of speeches. But I'll tell you, I'm getting roped back into TV, I think. I did some television for Investigation Discovery. We did a 3-part series on the JonBenet Ramsey case, which I covered years ago. And now we've done 2 more specials that are coming out soon. One is on the Casey Anthony case from down there in Florida, which I also covered.
Really?
And the Chandra Levy case, if you remember that one out of D.C., where the missing intern who had the congressman boyfriend, the married congressman boyfriend. So those specials will be coming up soon on Investigation Discovery. And I might have something else TV-wise in the works pretty soon, but I can't talk about that yet. See, I'll have to come back again.
You've got to come back again. Yeah. But JonBenet, did you come to Atlanta for that? Because, you know, I think the Mr. Ramsey and his son still live in Atlanta now.
That's right. No, this was a sort of a retrospective of the case, of the whole murder case of JonBenet. So no, I didn't go to Atlanta, but I've been in Atlanta. Went there for what is the young girl's name? Natalie Holloway story. Remember the girl who went missing in Aruba and they never found her.
Yeah.
That was
a lot of good cases.
Yeah.
Okay. So she will be back. You've heard it here. We're so thrilled to have you, Diane Dimond.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being patient.
Oh, it was an absolute pleasure. And don't forget, to our friend here, Kenya Colbert, her show, Everything Relationships, has moved to a new day and time. It's Sundays at 5:30. And we are Madame Perry Salon signing off with Everybody's Got to Swing.
Bye,
good night.
Bye.